kind of Pyrrhic game of whack-a-mole or moving the goalposts. But the other really important point, and the reason I wrote the book, Amy, was in response to a year of discussions I've had with Mr. Kennedy, you know, going through all of this. We have at least 100 autism genes that have been identified, many here in Boston at the Broad Institute at Harvard MIT. We did genomic sequencing on Rachel and my wife Ann, and I found Rachel's autism genes. And they all operate in early fetal brain development. Very early on in pregnancy, that's when autism occurs. This is a genetic process. And yet he dismisses all of the massive scientific evidence, the fact that all of this is occurring in pregnancy. And by the way, I even had discussions with him saying, yes, there could be some environmental exposures, but not vaccines. These are environmental exposures that are occurring early on in pregnancy. Let me give you an example. If you're pregnant, and maybe don't realize it, and you're on an anti-seizure medication called Depakote, also known as valproic acid, you have a much higher likelihood of giving birth to a child with an autism phenotype. And there's at least half a dozen chemical exposures that I shared with Mr. Kennedy to look into this, but it's all occurring during pregnancy. And I was very puzzled by his lack of interest in it. I even said, you know, Bobby, I was calling him Bobby then, and I said, you should be all over this. You're an environmental attorney. This is your sweet spot. This is your moment to really look into this. This is 8 years ago. And he had no interest in it. He had this kind of fixed belief about vaccines when there was not only was there massive evidence showing there's no link, but the lack of plausibility, Amy. I think that's what's the most important part, is this is all occurring in early fetal brain development.
So what do you make of Bobby Kennedy saying that he will discover the cause of autism by September?
Yeah, that one's a head scratcher, because first of all, there's at least 100 autism genes. There are many different forms of autism, and it's not a simple cause, right? It's clearly the genetic component is huge. There could be some environmental exposures early on in pregnancy. That would all be very reasonable for him to look at, but the way he frames it is almost childlike. It's very simplistic, saying he's going to find the cause of autism. There is not a cause. It is a complex set of interactions between genes and the environment, very much like cancer. It's almost like saying that he's going to find the cause of cancer by September. It makes no sense on scientific grounds, and that's been explained to him in detail.
Let me go to the Health and Human Services Secretary, Bobby Kennedy, speaking at a news conference Wednesday morning.
Autism destroys families. More importantly, it destroys our greatest resource, which are our children. These are children who should not be suffering like this. These are kids who, many of them, were fully functional and regressed because of some environmental exposure into autism when they're 2 years old. And these are kids who will never pay taxes. They'll never hold a job. They'll never play baseball. They'll never write a poem. They'll never go out on a date. Many of them will never use a toilet unassisted. And we have to recognize we are doing this to our children.
So that is Bobby Kennedy, your response, Dr. Hotez, as an autism dad yourself as well.
Yeah, well, it's misguided on multiple levels. So let's unpack it a bit. The second point where he talks about autism and not paying taxes, never working. Look, my daughter, Rachel, she's a young adult. She's in her early 30s. She can't live by herself. She lives with us And has been living with us, but she works every day at Goodwill. She pays taxes. She earns money. She loves going to work. She walks to work. She has friends at work. She goes to the movies. And the way he portrays autism in these very dark terms simply doesn't reflect the vast majority of people who live on the autism spectrum. So I found that deeply offensive, and it has, you know, this kind of creepy tone to it as well, which we can go into more if you like. But, you know, the other piece to this is, you know, he also misrepresents the processes of autism. Autism occurs in early fetal brain development, and the full clinical expression often will not manifest until 1 or 2 years of age. And it can be shown that that clinical expression of autism coincides, this is work done at the University of North Carolina, Chapel Hill, with a big increase in brain volume expansion as evidenced on imaging MRI studies. But you can actually go back months or even at the beginning of life and show that those increases in brain volume expansion are already beginning in as a consequence of the activity of autism genes. And so, again, he misrepresented, saying these kids had no issues at all, and all of a sudden there was some deus ex machina, you know, this kind of intervention that suddenly made them autistic. That's not what occurs. And we have this well documented, well detailed, and then the science is quite clear. It doesn't mean that we understand every aspect of autism, but, you know, that's how he needs to talk about it, saying, look, you know, through funding supported by the National Institutes of Health, we've learned an awful lot about the causes of autism, how autism genes operate, how they interact with environmental factors, how then the full clinical expression occurs between 1 and 2 years of age. And that's where he needs to go and say, okay, now we're going to bring all of the world's experts together. And we have an enormous amount of intellectual horsepower on autism here in the United States, and bring them together and say, what are the gaps? What else do we need to look at? But he, again, shows this consistent lack of intellectual curiosity, this kind of simplistic way of thinking, and talking about autism, in my view, in what almost seems to be like eugenics terms. And I found it very offensive.
Last month, switching gears a bit, Dr. Hotez, the top vaccine regulator at the Food and Drug Administration, Dr. Peter Marks, resigned after being forced out by HHS Secretary Bobby Kennedy. In his resignation letter, Dr. Marks wrote, quote, "It has become clear that truth and transparency are not desired by the secretary, but rather he wishes subservient confirmation of his misinformation and lies," unquote. If you can talk more about what's happening at this point to HHS, and specifically also talk about the flu vaccine and the cancellation of the meeting that would determine the strains of flu in a new vaccine.
Well, you know, I do not have the inside baseball on what's going on at FDA or HHS. It's a bit opaque right now, more opaque than it's ever been. But, you know, I will say in regard to Dr. Marks's letter, you know, that sounds about right, that Mr. Kennedy seems to have this fixed belief that vaccines do bad things to kids, and he's absolutely wrong. I mean, we have this extraordinary vaccine ecosystem that's led to the elimination of multiple childhood infections, including HIV meningitis and measles and many others. And now I'm really concerned that he is so fixed on these false links between vaccines and autism and other things that this is going to jeopardize our entire vaccine ecosystem. That's point one. Point two, I don't know what this means now when there's efforts to introduce new vaccines. You know, the technology technology now is really advancing rapidly. We have the opportunity to build next generation vaccines for emerging diseases. I'm very concerned about H5N1, and we need better vaccines for H5N1. We may have another coronavirus illness coming online. Remember, we've had SARS in 2002, which is a coronavirus, MERS in 2012, then of course COVID-19 in 2019, and I'm worried that we could have another one as well. And we always need, and the vaccine producers are always refining and improving vaccines, and I'm worried that all innovation is going to stop. On top of the fact, number three, that we're gutting the NIH, and we're facing potentially 40% cuts to the National Institutes of Health for all of our innovation. And that includes, Amy, new vaccines, not only for infectious diseases, but non-communicable diseases. For instance, we've been historically making low-cost recombinant protein vaccines, but now our scientists in the labs at Texas Children's Hospital Center for Vaccine Development have really improved mRNA vaccine delivery. And now we have some exciting collaborations with our cancer center at Baylor to maybe, and we're now looking into making a mRNA vaccine for triple-negative breast cancer, for which you can not use recombinant protein technology. There's some limits to that technology. So I think we're going to need mRNA for that. Is that all going to stop now with this new regime? And that also concerns me.
Dr. Peter Hotez, I want to thank you so much for being with us. Dean of the National School of Tropical Medicine and professor at Baylor College of Medicine in Texas, where he's also the co-director of the Texas Children's Center for Vaccine Development, author of several books, including The Deadly Rise of Anti-Science, A Scientist's Warning, and Vaccines Did Not Cause Rachel's Autism, My Journey as a Vaccine Scientist, Pediatrician, and Autism Dad. Coming up next, 25-year-old photojournalist from Gaza, Fatma Hassouna, was just killed in an Israeli airstrike. She's the subject of a new documentary that was just accepted into Cannes Film Festival, and she was deciding whether she would be able to go. The documentary called Put Your Soul on Your Hand and Walk. We'll speak with the well-known director of that documentary, Sepideh Farsi. Stay with us.
Mama, I'm sorry I didn't believe you when you told me that you were proud of me. But now I believe it because I see the vision and now you're kind of funny calling me. الربط اتخرج وصحابي glad, but the real ones always right beside of me. Said I got a mission to fight for my people at home and provide for the family. I want to get rich and I want to get famous, but not for the reason you think. I want to be able to cover tuitions without even having to blame. I want to be able to go to a family in Gaza and tell them it's over, we made it, then do it again and again and again and again and again and again. شايف زهرة جوا الصحراء هيني عايش جوا اللحظة طول عمري ما خبالي طبيعي كله روح بطلقة. شايف زهرة جوا الصحراء هيني عايش جوا اللحظة طول عمري ما خبالي طبيعي كله روح بطلقة.
Desert Rose by Saint Laurent. This is Democracy Now!, democracynow.org, The War and Peace Report. I'm Amy Goodman. Fatma Hassouna was a 25-year-old photographer and artist from Gaza who documented the devastating impacts on Israel's war on Gaza. She's also the subject of a new documentary called Put Your Soul on Your Hand and Walk. On Wednesday morning, Fatma was killed, along with at least 9 members of her family, in an Israeli airstrike on her home in northern Gaza. Fatma was killed a day after the documentary was accepted at the Cannes Film Festival. This is part of the trailer of the film.
Where are you now?
I'm in North Gaza. This is my neighborhood. No one lives here, or there, or there. There's no one.
When the war started on October 7th, I was traveling around the world, presenting my last film that talks about a war I've personally experienced as a teenager in Iran. I decided to go to Cairo in order to cross through Rafah, but I couldn't because all the roads to Gaza were blocked. Instead, I started filming Palestinian refugees who were just arriving from Gaza. Through one of them, I came to know Fatem.
I'm a photographer.
Yes, I saw your photos. Meeting her was like a mirror held in front of me that made me realize how much both our lives are conditioned by walls and wars.
Part of the trailer of the new documentary, Put Your Soul on Your Hand and Walk. We're joined now by the film's director, Sepideh Farsi, award-winning Iranian filmmaker who's speaking to us from Paris. Sepideh, welcome to Democracy Now! Our deepest condolences on the death of Fatma Hassona, who you were introducing the world to even further in this new documentary. Can you tell us who she was, what she did, and how she died?
Hi, Amy. I'm so devastated. It's really hard to... I can't believe she's gone. I don't know how to talk. I met her a year ago, as you heard in the trailer. Sorry. And
take your time. I know how unbelievably, horrifyingly difficult this is. As I watched your documentary, I mean, the time you have spent with her on over Zoom, trying to talk, reconnect, the fear every single time you reached out to her that this might be the last conversation is just... That is the feeling you have throughout this documentary is, will Sepideh reach her again? And what an unbelievably radiant smile, Fatma, in describing the most difficult situations that her family was in and the number of people that have died around her. That is what infuses the entire documentary.
Yes, she was exactly as you described her, Amy, a solar person, you know, radiating, very brave, resilient, young also, hopeful, sometimes in despair, but generally very strong, optimistic and very with a huge integrity. Of course, throughout that year, it was a year of connections on and off and very often, as much as we could. Many times I feared for her life. Every day I wrote to her if she couldn't connect, at least we would exchange some texts and audio messages and photos, anything we could. And most of the time we would connect to talk and I would film the video calls. And yes, every day and every night I feared for her life. And somehow by the end of this period and when the selection was announced and I had started the, you know, I told her 2 days ago, just the day before she left us, she was killed, that the film was selected. She was immensely glad. I said, do you accept to come? She said, yes, on the condition that I go back to Gaza afterwards. I want to be there. The Israeli occupation wants us to leave. I do not want to leave. I will keep my land and my house like the other Palestinians. But we were trying to get her out at least for the film's presentation. And a day after I just learned the news, I can't believe it. I can't tell you how devastated I am. And we lost a great person.
Khan put out a statement. Is it pronounced ACID, the ACID team?
Yes.
That said about Fatma Hassouna after she was killed, her smile was as magical as her tenacity, bearing witness, photographing Gaza, distributing food despite the bombs, mourning and hunger. We heard her story, rejoiced at each of her appearances to see her alive. We feared for her. they said. So if you can tell us how she came to pick up her camera, and one of the just so poignant through this documentary is we meet one by one, even your surprise, in meeting her family members who happen to be in the space she's in wherever she manages to connect to you. We meet her brother. We meet her dad. We look at them looking at you, who is uncovered, a woman speaking to her in Paris or wherever you are. But she, all her life, has only been in Gaza.
Yes, exactly. This was a big thing for me also, and for her. I shared it with her in the sense that I had many moments of doubt, of feeling guilty, of doubting whether or not I should, exchange and share with her all of my travels and my adventures and what I was up to. And at some point, I thought that it was my way of contributing to giving her something she didn't know yet, because she never had a chance to be out of Gaza. And the first time we met, she was telling me, oh, you're from Iran. One of the cities I would love to see is Tehran. And I told her, I cannot go back to Tehran myself. And she's like, why? I said, because of political reasons. It was such an absurdity to her. She couldn't even imagine how other people than Palestinians could be locked out of their country, whereas these people are locked in their country and cannot go out. I mean, it was such a contrast between what I was living and she was living. And we put up with it, and we built the whole film and our relationship around this discrepancy of our experiences. And I think that was one of the points that it was very rich in our exchanges, that I do not believe in God and she did. And I am in exile and she was stuck in her country. And so it was even more, moving, I think, for me, and I believe for her as well. She the first time I told her, you're so young, you're my daughter's age. And she said, oh, you could be my mother. You know, it's like, and she was so spontaneous, so generous, and so systematic in her documenting the genocide also, and in her vision of what they were going through, such a clarity. Despite her young age, or because of her young age, I don't know, maybe.
We're showing her photographs, by the way, as we talk to you. I want to ask you how you met, but can you tell us how she died first this week?
I still keep asking myself the question whether there was a link between the film selection in Cannes, and just a day later, her house being hit. Well, the house was hit by a bomb. People say it was targeted. I do believe that it could be the case, given the high number of the journalists and photographers in Gaza who've been killed by the Israeli army. So I think this one time, it could be one of these cases. Of course, I do not know more than that. I would love to an investigation to be done to find out, because she was so dear to me and to many of us. But the fact is that the bomb was launched on our house, and the whole house was destroyed. She and 9 other members of her family, including all those whom I knew, died. I'm trying to learn. There might be that her parents or one of the 2 parents are still alive, badly injured. I'm still looking for news. I do not know. But for sure, the number of deaths is 10 and the injuries 11. And I will never know, I think, until we do an investigation, why that house was hit.
And Sepideh, how did you meet Fatma?
As I explained in the trailer and the beginning of the film, I at some point touring the world with my previous film, the animation, The Siren, I was following the news of the war, of course, on Gaza, and to begin with, October 7th, and then all that unfolded afterwards. And a piece of that puzzle was missing. Well, you see my cat, who's in the film. Sorry, she's always in the image. that a piece, a big piece of the puzzle was missing for me, and that was the Palestinian point of view and the Palestinian narrative. And at some point, it became so unbearable to me that I decided to go to Gaza to through Rafah. So I went to Cairo to pass through, but it was already too late. Plus, I have a French passport, born in Iran. It was not possible. And so I started working with Palestinian refugees in Cairo, and through one of them, I was introduced to Fatem online, and that's how it started. It was immediate. Connection was immediate.
And talk about why she first picked up this camera. I mean, unbelievably dangerous. She has died with so many members of her family, but other members of her family, like her grandfather, her uncle, also died while she was alive in this last year and a half.
I think part of the Palestinian destiny or the Gazawi destiny is that they knew there's this fatality. I would refuse to accept it, but I think they had this, you know, when she says in the film, she says they cannot defeat us because we have nothing to lose. It's so enormous to hear. It takes time to take it in and to realize what she means. Now I realize what she meaning. I mean, of course, you have your life to lose, but I think there is this fatality they're prepared for. So, yes, she had lost 13 members of her family, if I remember correctly, in January 2024 already. She told me about them one by one. She named them and their ages and all in the film in several times. And despite that, she would not give up taking photos and documenting, and that was essential to her. Writing also, because she was also a poet, as you said, but photography, I think, was her main and most serious activity. I did ask her whether she would like to continue music, because she also sang and writing, and she said, no, photography is the most important for me. And she herself described her camera as a gun. She said, you know, like the sniper who ups the gun and shoots, I lift my camera and I shoot a photo. And it is essential to document this war and the genocide. And she kept saying that all the time. So I think it was very important to her that her photos and her work generally, texts also, would remain and be relayed and shared with larger audiences. And that's what I will be trying to do by all means.
Do you have her poem in front of you that you could read?
I can find it.
We're talking to Sepideh Farsi, the award-winning Iranian filmmaker. She's based in Paris. Her new documentary film, Put Your Soul on Your Hand and Walk, features Fatma Hassana, who died this week. She told Fatma the day before she died in Israeli airstrike with, it's believed, 9 members of her family, that the film had just been accepted at the Cannes Film Festival and she wanted her to be there. Did you find the film,
Yes. The
poem?
Yes, this is one of her poems, The Man Who Wore His Eyes. I don't have a CV to recognize 2 eyes, mysterious, and I believe. I do not have a story, one clear, for a stranger to believe it. And he believes. I have no physical characteristics complete to fly outside of this gravity, and I believe. Maybe I'm ushering in my death now before the person standing in front of me lifts his sharp sniper rifle, and it ends, and I'm done. Silence. Are you a fish? I did not answer when the sea asked me. I didn't know where these crows came from and pounced on my flesh. Would it have seemed logical if I said yes? Let these crows pounce at the end on a fish. She crossed, and I did not cross. My death crossed me, and a sharp sniper bullet. I became an angel for a city, huge, bigger than my dreams, bigger than this city. I became a poetry saint.
We're ending the show. I want to thank you so much. We'll post the poem online. Sepideh Farsi, the award-winning documentary filmmaker, Fatma Hassouna, the subject of her film, has been killed.
You're listening to